Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with myself because Derek can't come. But I'm very excited to welcome back to the podcast today Anton Yeager. You know him, but he is also the departmental lecturer in the history of political thought and political theory at University College Oxford. And I've invited Anton to talk about the election. So, Anton, perhaps I should start with a question. We could talk about a lot of things: the realignment of the working class, de-alignment of the working class, the fact that maybe this is just a normal thing that happens when there's inflation, maybe the Democrats went wrong with strategy. But I'm curious, what story do you think Trump's election contributes to? Obviously, not everyone is going to have a grand theory of the election, but what do you think Trump's election suggests at whatever level, micro, meso, macro?
So I think it's too premature, too early to even speak of a new political order. There was a piece by Tim Barker in Sidebar that I think was rightly critical of some of the more liberal alarmist takes that see this victory as somehow inaugurating a wholly new political epoch. There is, of course, this long-standing theory in American politics of so-called presidential regimes. So you have a president that actually innovates, and then the next president basically has to function within the structure that's set by the previous president. I think we can even ask ourselves the question whether Trump has managed to establish not just a new order or a new presidential regime. What I do think it crucially shows, and it's a very basic but important point, is that 2016 is not a blip. And I don't think anyone could still pretend, and certainly on the side of the liberalism that lost in this election, as if 2016 is reversible and that a return to normality was possible. And in fact, many people knew this already because Bidenism was actually a continuation of so much of what Trumpism was, also in terms of foreign policy. So it's not as if that intuition was absent everywhere, but it's now becoming much clearer with the fact that he's managed to win this election, that the grip on power is stronger. I think there is more of a program than there was in 2016. And the most important story is just to treat this not as something that is exceptional. It's not an outlier. It's now going to become quite a permanent feature of our politics. And the question also from the left means, what does that mean? What does it mean that it can't just be reversed, that liberalism can just get back in the saddle and all that? And that's a discussion to be had, because there are certain strategic questions that also come from the fact that it's now a permanent, durable feature of American, and I'd say also of global politics, and what that implies.
So I'm glad you mentioned liberalism, because to me, that is my emergent grand theory of the election that I was arguing in favor of beforehand. And this, to me, really solidifies it, which is that the story of the age is not really about the emergence of the far right or even right-wing populism, but it's much more so about the failure of liberalism itself and the crisis of liberalism. That liberalism, either absence a Soviet threat that was able to moderate it in the United States and promote things like social democratic military Keynesianism or a form of racial liberalism that you get through the Civil Rights Act, that liberalism has really run aground, that it doesn't really know what to do, that it is unable to correct itself because of its hegemony and because of its institutions. But I do think what is unique about this moment, perhaps, is that you have institutions I'm speaking specifically in the arena of foreign policy, like the National Security Council or CIA, but also in the domestic sphere, Council of Economic Advisors, et cetera, that are, I would say, specifically liberal institutions. But at the same time that these liberal institutions continue to exist, you have a liberalism itself that is waning, that is unsure of itself, that really can't self-correct. Because it's not like this was an especially surprising outcome. You had a left populist challenge in the form of Bernie Sanders at the exact same time as Trump. That populist challenge was able to be amalgamated into the Republican Party, and it has not only been not able to be amalgamated into the Democratic Party, it was really strangled in the crib by Barack Obama and other party elites, that they weren't unlike earlier examples in the history of the 20th century United States, able to amalgamate the critique, especially when we consider the fact that just in pure historical terms, Bernie Sanders was not really asking for much more than a return to a New Deal liberalism updated for the 21st century, dealing with 21st century problems like healthcare, housing costs, student debt, what have you. But liberalism wasn't even able to amalgamate that critique, but was strong enough to basically destroy it, leaving it in a very strange position. So I'm curious, what do you think about the position of liberalism itself? Is liberalism in crisis? Talking about American liberalism, is there nowhere for it to go? Is it shorn of its utopian vista and thereby can only say, well, actually, you fucking idiots, the macroeconomy is fine. What the fuck is wrong with you? To me, the most important story of the election is much less about Trump, who, given his appointment, seemed to be doing what Trump did in 2016, appointing kind of strange people. Who knows how long they'll last? Something tells me that in the White House itself, Elon Musk is not going to love using the bureaucracy and is probably not going to be able to really manipulate it in the way that someone who knows it, very similar. But it's really the liberals who are the ones to focus on because they seem unable to self-correct after very clear signals were sent in 2016, 2020, and again in 2024. So I'd love to hear you talk about the character of modern liberalism or what you think about that thesis that I put forth.
Yeah, I think I agree on it, and I'd extend it on several levels. So there was a phrase by the French philosopher Baudrillard I used in a recent piece for the New Left Review where he compared American hegemony, I'd say American liberal hegemony, to the loss of protection or the loss of resistance in a kind of overprotected organism. And I think this is precisely the problem of the incapacity for hegemonic self-correction means is that if your hegemony becomes so absolute and very solitary, that means you also lose the sources of discipline that allowed you to stabilize systems just before. I mean, it seems like an abstract point, but it's very basic in that being trained through class conflict also applies to the other side of the class war in many ways, and not just the capitalist class, but I think, as you say, a specific liberal institutional complex has really lost the sources of discipline that it still had throughout the 20th century. And we're seeing all kinds of pathologies, which, as you say, the clearest pathology is not the self-engineered or the incredibly impressive rise of the far right, because I do think the success of the far right is predominantly a function of liberalism's failure rather than...
Precisely. And people miss that. It's not really the strength of the far right. It's about the weakness of liberalism.
So I think Adam Tooze made a version of this argument in a recent piece in the London Review of Books, calling it the Democrats' defeat rather than the Republicans' victory. And I think that in many ways might be a narrow frame, but it's an important frame in that it applies also to liberalism as a whole. Many of the pathologies on the right and on the far right in American politics today, and even in European politics, it doesn't just apply in the US, it also applies in Europe, are a function of liberalism's failure to stabilize its hegemony rather than an insurgency from outside as such. And in that sense, I think it also tells us a lot about what's wrong with the so-called fascism discussion, which we might get to later, is that what is really crucial about any discussion of fascism in the early inception period in the 20s and 30s, whether it's the Italian or the German or other variants, is that once again, it had to be understood in a double sense that fascism expresses a double crisis. It expresses the crisis of liberalism and the crisis of socialism, in that socialism comes close to a revolutionary moment, fails to seize it, and liberalism, certainly after the Great World War in 1914, but then also after the 1928 stock market crash, also fails to stabilize its rule. And fascism kind of steps into that void. And it has a double purpose. It helps liberal elites to resolve the crisis. And at the same time, it crushes socialism, which has failed to seize its revolutionary moment. And today, and I think this is really crucial and it helps to understand what the Trumpian or what that new far right actually is, there is no such threat from the left. And what we're seeing is purely and exclusively a function of the crisis of liberalism. And I think this also helps against the sense of overestimation and the sense of, I'd say, lack of, a real sense, or lack of subjectivity, I'd say, also on the left, or a capacity to judge your own power accordingly by the fact that what we're seeing is external pathologies of liberalism that are, as you say, failing or imploding rather than insurgents from outside that are threatening it. And it's quite a dispiriting diagnosis because it does mean that it's not as if there are that many alternatives to liberalism either.
There are basically none today. I mean, the left has been eradicated. It's not an actual threat. So then the question that I have for you is why did the fascism debate, first among intellectuals, but then why was it embraced by the Harris campaign in the last week or so? Why did it become so powerful rhetorically? I mean, there are obvious reasons that, there are other moments in history where people call something and it doesn't, ignite years of recriminatory debate. So what do you think was so powerful? Because my perhaps too psychological explanation, and this isn't the time, but I also found the return of Freud to be a bit weak. I don't know if you've noticed that. That's been like a thing in the United States amongst some intellectuals, amongst the intellectual set, like Freud has returned in kind of a strange way and kind of a little bit of a bastardized Freud and a not super contextualized Freud, which I always found strange and interesting. But to me, the fascism debate, and this is coming from a very American perspective, so tell me if I'm wrong, was a way for basically milquetoast liberals to reaffirm a world historical mission for themselves in the actual absence of one. And it was everything that came along with that. You have the affective feelings of feeling like you're part of a great struggle. You have the political disciplining of the left, which that certainly helps to apply. This is the best you can get, you fucking idiots, so you better vote for us. But I was wondering if you just think it was that, because I think the interesting thing about the fascism debate to me has always been less about the diagnosis of fascism, which on its face is absurd, in my opinion. If you truly know the history, I was always very surprised that any historians basically aligned with the pro side. It turned out to be, I think a lot of them were a little bit older, a little bit maybe more easily scared. And I think we all know who I'm talking about. But the social meaning of the debate is interesting. So what do you attribute that social meaning? Why did it become so vitriolic and so powerful?
I don't think it's possible to detect one impulse or isolate it in such a way that really drives the entire debate. I think there's a very basic fact, which might seem cynical, but which is very important, is that an anti-fascist campaign or embracing the rhetoric around fascism doesn't cost you that much. It's just politically cheaper because almost materially it commits you to a defense of regime normality, you could say, and it sidelines all kinds of questions of redistribution and of economics and of economic power, the question of how you actually tackle the growing power of capital or in the existent power of capital in the U.S., and you just turn it into a defense of liberal normality in the name of anti-fascism. So the fact that when Harris was running a campaign on the idea that let's actually beat fascism, but you're not going to actually tell us what the ambitious program is going to be to beat the social sources of fascism, it just means that it's cheaper. It costs less than actually embracing any more ambitiously social liberalism. And it's a striking, I think, contrast also with the New Deal liberalism that once had the Popular Front rhetoric at its center, is that that New Deal liberalism at least was socially a bit more ambitious. And so describing it as a variant of American social democracy is obviously quite problematic, and we can have a long discussion about how to conceptualize the New Deal, but it's undeniable that New Deal liberalism was far more socially ambitious than anything we've seen with Bidenism. Bidenism in many ways, just an attempt to sort of fiscally or even just financially stimulate private capital to invest in greener ways, but in no way was it an actual attack on capitalist control over the investment function. So that, I think, is the first point to make it just cost less. And then, again, I do think you're also right. There is a sense of historical mission, or at least of energy, which liberalism since the 90s and the 2000s has sorely lacked because of its disappearing opponents. So I remember there was a moment after 9/11 at which liberalism felt, oh, we need to become more combative, we need to become more martial, you need to make a so-called civilizational case for liberalism, which is now not being made anymore. When Trump got elected, there's a sense of, oh, what does liberalism actually mean in the 21st century? Well, it means opposing this. And we have a long history to fall back on. Trump isn't just one of the foes. There aren't many foes also abroad. You can clearly see this in Snyder's work that it gives you, I would say it gives you a philosophy, sorry, it gives liberalism a philosophy of history almost, which it had lost out on since the 1990s.
But a philosophy of history without a future, this is what's strange, yes. Right? I mean, this is why I think Fukuyama was correct. Regardless of what he says, there has not been genuine ideological challengers to liberalism. There just really, in my opinion, haven't.
No.
How could you have a philosophy of history without a future? It's very strange.
Well, and in that sense, I say it's a pseudo-philosophy of history because it has a theory of, you could say, directionality in history. History is this battle between good and evil, also in American politics, and now evil has returned, and then we need to gather our forces to fight it. But indeed, its vision of the future is remarkably conservative. It's basically an attempt to return to a status quo ante, which has been upset by 2016. And there's never, ever, many people have made this point, but it's important to repeat it, a positive articulation of what you're actually defending. And so,
is that because there isn't something to defend? And this leads me to my next question. Where do you think capital is now in its own historical cycle? Because maybe I've become persuaded recently of the general falling rate of profit thesis, just in its most macro sense, that you're going to make less money in the 21st century than you did in the 19th when you're, for example, building St. Louis or building the entirety of the American West. There's no way that even Meta or Google or however you fake the market capitalization of those firms is going to basically give you the same amount of profit. And this to me really became clear because I've been doing work in Hollywood in a variety of different directions. And capital, as I'm sure you're well aware, has flooded Hollywood in the last 15, 20 years. You've got venture capital, you've got hedge funds, you've got the index funds investing in Hollywood. But Anton, I hate to tell you, Hollywood's a shitty fucking business. It's incredibly difficult to know what's actually going to make money. Most of the times you lose money and there's really not a way to ensure a high rate of return, no matter how much labor you get rid of, no matter how many quantitative metrics you align. So to me, the idea of why this capital is flooding Hollywood is a larger instantiation of capital doesn't know where to go. Capital is not producing wealth or not producing growth in the way that it did. I'm just curious if you agree with that or if you disagree with that. And if so, either way, how do you think that played into this election with, like you say, Bidenomics being like, please, capital, invest in solar energy, when ideally it could be read, climate change is a major existential crisis, at least if not to humanity as a whole, then to the consumptive way of living that Western subjects have been living under for 50 plus years.
Yes, I think there's several discussions here that come together, and I think we should be careful to separate them. So the falling rate of profit thesis, the overcapacity thesis, saturation thesis, you could say, and all of that. But those are debates which overlap in many ways, but shouldn't be put into one basket and treated as part of sort of one central question. I do think, yes, we live in a low growth economy, certainly in the West in that sense. And it is a massive problem for something like a green transition, where incentivizing capital in that low growth environment, in an environment of saturation. So the question whether there's a falling rate of profit, I think, is still open in many regards, because there are companies that are still making massive profits. So it's not impossible. The question is,
the question is just, are the profits real?
Yes. Right?
It's difficult in a highly financialized economy to do apples to apples comparisons.
It's a massive debate. It's a massive debate.
Like if you look at, just for listeners, if you look at the market cap at one of these tech firms, it absurdly outstrips their actual profits per year. You know, it's basically the market making monopoly plays for a small number of industries. But I just wanted to give the context for people who might not know.
Yes. And I don't think resolving that question is necessary or is required to read the relationship between the American election result and the rearrangement or the reordering of the internal relationships within American capital at the moment. So I think there are conflicts between different capital fractions within that low growth environment, which is undeniable. So low growth and the fact that there is an element of saturation in many markets, which makes it more difficult for capital. And of course, there's the so-called Dylan Riley and Robert Brenner thesis that says that due to this overcapacity problem, capital increasingly turns to the state for profit guarantees. So it cannot guarantee profit on its own, and therefore it increasingly becomes dependent on the state. I have reservations about that thesis in some ways, but I think there is a central truth to this. You very clearly can see this in the American election. Capital is absolutely centrally dependent on state power, whether it's through Biden or through Trump, to actually guarantee some of its profit rates. And this, I think, is also why it was still the most expensive election in American history, because capital needs state power on a very, very important level. And then the question becomes, what parts of capital actually gather around what party? And there, it does seem as if, yes, the fractions around the Democratic Party are more interested in a green transition, while there are parts of carbon capital that feel far more attracted around Trump. But I think the key question is different insofar as it means, what does it mean to live in a world in which the absolute hegemony of capital, not just liberalism, but capital, also makes it difficult for them, one, to articulate a long-term interest for them as a whole. So the idea of how they can come up with a notion of what they need as a class in the long term, that's become increasingly difficult. And at the same time, they find it increasingly hard to contain internal differences and disagreements. And I think you can clearly see this, that they don't have one party they can actually unite to. Different fractions of capital disagree quite severely on where economic policy and investment should go. And I think so much of American politics in the last 20, 30 years, particularly in the last 10 years, is more an expression of those internal contradictions within capital than it is the expression of some, whatever, like massive popular involvement or populist uproars, as it's called, that deregulate or that threaten the basis of elite power. And I mean, there's a debate to be had about foreign policy as well, which is quite complicated, but I think it is also an expression that there's less and less coherence within a class that's so used to having all the power that that has political consequences that are quite chaotic.
So what has your reaction to the various responses? So I could just say, from sitting in the U.S. itself and being somewhat embedded in these communities, it does seem like it's a very different reaction to 2016. There's a lot less garment rending. There's a lot less, there haven't been much talk about a women's march. There hasn't been much talk about sort of these mass mobilizations against Trump. There's been a muted response from the populace at large and sort of a semi-frantic response from the so-called liberal resistance, but less than 2016 and less than one might have expected. So I'm curious, what is your take on the responses? Has any pattern emerged to you, et cetera?
Yes, I think the key difference, of course, is that when in election night 2016, you were in the Trump headquarters, they themselves were surprised by the victory. So that's something they didn't expect, while now they felt vindicated. It's a kind of rightful restoration of their ruler. It's not a freak accident which puts them into power. And then conversely, on the liberal side, there was a sense of combativeness, a sense of a necessity to fight, the idea that there needed to be actual opposition and rebellion, and that rebelliousness has really subsided. What you see is a sense of desperation more, a sense of despondence, and on the other side, I'd say accommodation, which is clearly visible also in Biden's attitude and many others, is that they now realize that he's here to stay for the coming 4 years. Maybe there'll be several legal challenges, but it doesn't seem as if rebooting the entire Russiagate operation is going to be that successful. They might think of doing that around Tulsi Gabbard as an appointee, but seems very improbable.
It's not going to have the same juice, It's not going to have the same juice, yeah.
So they've done all these things before. They didn't work, and clearly maybe they have enough experience now then to know they won't work. So I think, yes, accommodation. So a mixture of desperation and accommodation is going to be the most dominant response. On the left, more I think there are variants of this, but what is really striking, and it of course has to do with the fact that there was a Bernie moment in 2016, which there isn't now. So many of the debates at the time, which actually thought very seriously about the question of what an American left-wing politics might look like outside and without the Democratic Party, have really quieted down, not to say disappeared. So in an era in which it seems even more urgent to have discussions about dirty breaks and whatever, left-wing caucuses, none of that is actually present. And if you look at something like
the
Squad...
This is the big question, right? Like, because after 2016, you saw the huge resurgence in left media. You saw DSA get many more members. You saw actual people were talking like it was the red summers of the early 20th century Europe. Like, there was going to be some genuine break. And not only, obviously, a lot of that fell victim to various infightings because it's a lot of identity politics. And basically, there are no disciplining institutions of the left. You know, DSA is the institution of the left, but it can't really exert any discipline, partially to the peculiar structure of the American party system, which is hardly a party system at all. I think you said something about that. It's like barely a party. These aren't real political parties. So, but why do you think there's been no reaction like that among the left?
I mean, the uncomfortable conclusion does seem to be that Bidenism has proven remarkably successful in integrating these left challenges as well. So you could say they crushed them. And I think there's certainly an element the Bernie campaign of support.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Pressure, but there's also an element of accommodation and integration, which you can clearly see in the Squad, but which you can see in Bernie as well, that there was this idea that Bidenism could pretend that it listened to the left and it absorbed some of its insights and was then implementing part of its program. And that means, I think, that parts of the party political left, but also the intellectual left, did see themselves as having some kind of stake in the entire Biden project. And this obviously then transitioned into an election campaign in which there was very little idea of what to choose between Biden and Trump, despite the fact that Biden was the one, for example, financing and sponsoring the genocide in Gaza. And now you're left in a situation at which the supposed mentor, I wouldn't say mentor, but the tactical Biden you frittered away all your chips on is now had lost the election, and you're left with a situation where, let me put it this way, you tied yourself to a sinking ship, and the ship has sunk, and you have to get your head above water and realize what's left and what to do about it. And it doesn't seem as if there are many, many options left. And I do think, so I'm speaking as a European here, and some people then get weirdly xenophobic when I have all these opinions about American politics.
Yeah, what a surprise. Xenophobia lives among left liberals.
Yeah. It's like, well, how is Belgium doing? How is Europe doing? And it's like, these are completely irrelevant questions. And in fact, it's increasingly, let me put it this way, the weakness of the American left is increasingly a European problem, because an imperial core without a proper left opposition is going to let the U.S. or the hegemon export destruction and regression across the globe as it continues. So the absence of a real left-wing opposition in the core is increasingly generating massive problems in Europe, and also in the global south. We don't, of course, have to talk about the Middle East. And it doesn't mean I blame these people for the weakness, but it does mean that there are certain intellectual priorities which are completely mistaken, and which are delaying the formation of an actual left opposition in the U.S.
Yeah, and I want to talk about hyperpolitics and what I call the end of mass democracy in a second, because I think they're complementary concepts. They overlap in some regards and don't overlap in others. I sent you that piece on it recently. So the left tied itself to not only a sinking ship, but a sinking ship that had to go to sleep by 4 p.m. And was defending it very rigidly for a long time. But to me, the big waking up moment was actually the Ukraine war, because it seemed to me that the left liberal and even some leftist advocacy for sending weapons to Ukraine in the failure of the global war on terror, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, what have you, was just profoundly disheartening and disillusioning, especially because then you have the United States very quickly thereafter supporting Israel's annihilation of Gaza, which looks like under Trump might very well lead to annexation of the West Bank as well. So what do you think was going on with left liberal support for the arming of Ukraine? Because obviously, like, Putin invaded, that's bad. You could say whatever is caused by structural conditions created by the United States, I agree. But in the end, Putin invaded and there was a choice, which are you going to send weapons? Are you going to support the empire or not? The empire was always going to do what it did. Blinken and Austin wanted to send weapons to give Russia their a new Afghanistan, basically. But why do you think left liberals and some on the left supported this? And what do you think that says about the view the left has toward U.S. foreign relations?
But to me, the most striking thing is the idea that you should have a position on this because that implies you have any control over what's happening. So there's already a complete overestimation of your own power. You're not the one who's actually going to decide what the weapons go or not. And so this is the first point to make. There's no reason to have this debate in a left that has no grip of any policy levers. It doesn't matter whether they're pro or contra because they're not the ones deciding whether the weapons are sent or not. So this is the first point to make. It's just that why is this pseudo debate being had in a world in which there's no left control over this policy domain? Foreign policy, of course, is, as we discussed before, one of the domains that's most insulated from popular pressure, certainly from left pressure. So why even have the debate? And then, of course, the question becomes, what does it mean not only to be unable to acknowledge your weakness, but also to think that so-called, let me put it this way. So control or support for some kind of imperial defense plan in Eastern Europe, no matter what Putin's own expansionist plans were. So it's not, of course, as if NATO did start the war, but they did set the contextual scene for the invasion. This is something that's completely undeniable. They created the context for something like this to happen.
What undeniable. So annoying when people deny it.
Yeah,
so
this
obvious.
Is something,
you know?
Yeah, it's something that's really difficult to tell people. Like, you don't have to blame NATO for the invasion to still say that it created the indispensable context for something like this to happen. And it contributed massively to it. And the second question then is, what does that imply on a global scale outside of Europe's eastern border? What does the strengthening of NATO and America's imperial control structure, what could it potentially apply elsewhere? And then I think later, when the actual Israeli punishment campaign began, I think you got a sense of what it meant to have a strengthened NATO in Europe and also in other places, and what this actually means for an incapacity for the European left to think independently of about foreign policy. And in that sense, it's been a really demoralizing time because it's not just about the weakness, but it's also just about the kind of intellectual agenda you need to have to actually think through your own weakness and then even imagine what it would mean to have some kind of power over these policy domains.
Yeah, I'm sure you listen to left media at least sometimes. The answer always seems to be organize, right? And which I joke, that is what the left says when they have no idea what to do. Because the role of the mass in 21st century society is not what it was in the 20th or late 19th century. So let's talk about hyperpolitics. Maybe you could just briefly explain what you mean by that concept and how you see it playing into the electoral outcome of 2024.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a tentative hypothesis, which I'm testing out and which I think has some benefits and some downsides. Just statistically, there's this striking observation that there's not just been a marked increase in turnout in many elections, in American presidential elections, but also in European elections in the last 10 years, which means that a classical story, which is often told about the 90s and 2000s, that they're an era of demobilization and severe depoliticization, is actually now more difficult to maintain. That diagnosis doesn't seem to hold anymore. And I think it opens up the question as to what does this repoliticization or a kind of moderate
re-involvement. Yeah, and you could see it in the crude measure of this was like one of the most well-attended presidential elections in history. 2020 was the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Very crude, but very real.
Yeah. And it's the same holds obviously for other indices, such as protest activity. There's been a massive explosion of protests in the 2010s, but also in the last year. So all of those, I think, are not random indicators. They do point towards a increased investment in politics that should be taken seriously. At the same time, there's another axis that crosses this rising graph, which is that the crisis of the membership model, not just of political parties, which don't really exist in the US, but even of other civil society organizations, has only increased in the last 10 to 15 years. So as you say, the decline of mass democracy, not just on the economic, but also the social and the political front, has only accelerated as this repoliticization has gone through. And it leads to this very strange situation where you have a feeling...
And just very, very quick, Anton, and yeah. I want to just add to your thesis, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the... I think that explains a lot of the affective feeling of the moment. Would yes. you have this hyper-politicization at a moment when you can't actually make political change? So yeah. people feel fucking nuts. And I think that's one of the major reasons why, just my little tangent.
Yeah. No, and I think so... An important factor does seem to be that it's easier for people to get politically involved. The costs of political expression have really decreased, also thanks to the internet. It's much easier to mobilize people. More people are being mobilized. And I'd say also the world has gotten worse. So obviously people are more worried and they want to get politically involved. But at the same time, we live in a society and also an economy in which it's become increasingly difficult to channel that political energy into anything more permanent and durable. And that means that much of what the left has to do is become hostage to these really short media cycles and, you'd say, sort of, yeah, politics of scandal, basically, in which it becomes incredibly difficult to think, well, where do we want to be in 1 year or in 5 years or in 10 years? And instead, you have the politics with the memory of a goldfish. And it's very exhausting, just firstly, because it means you're constantly getting worked up about the next big thing and then you have to get rid of it. And I do think that despite the urgency of all the crises which characterize the 21st century, whether it's the Israeli expansion campaign or, for example, climate change, the left really needs to be very patient and realistic about what it can achieve. And this means that the real results will be measured in decades and centuries, and we might not live to even see them if anything's going to happen at all. And I know that's a very pessimistic conclusion, but we need, both in Europe, but also in the US, people just need to stop thinking in the idea that there's going to be one big march and then everything will be changed. What Kautsky called the strategy of patience before the first war is unfortunately where it has to start. And you don't have to be a fan of Kautsky to agree that his hunch is the best. Certainly for the 21st
century.
Got to
be honest,
century.
Anton, I don't think today there's many fans or not fans of Kautsky. I don't think anyone, many people fucking read Kautsky. But yes, these big debates before the war, before the great schism, as Shorsky called it.
Yeah. And we're really back at ground zero in many ways, certainly after this election. And the first necessity is to realize that, just how steep the climb is going to be. And how minute and how small your control over the situation is.
So let's turn to the empire, because again, you have a strange situation. Objectively, the United States and let's say the G7 has been on significant decline, at least when it turns to share of global GDP, which is roughly not a bad thing to measure. But also objectively, you have a security order in which the United States still has the capacity to destroy most regions of the world. So that's strange, right? Economic decline, but basically military hyperpower exists. But at the same time, you also have within the actual people who staff institutions in Washington, D.C., the embrace of fantasia, for example, the belief that the United States will be able to, in a generation, still be hegemonic in East Asia. It seems impossible when you're talking about China, a country that is in East Asia. The United States is not going to be as hegemonic. So you have the empire itself being in a strange position. So I'm curious first, and then I want to get to Europe, but first, just looking globally, what's your understanding of the actual position of the empire itself?
So there is something striking, I'd say, about the U.S. as a hegemon compared to its predecessor, Britain, is that the U.S. has been more successful at reestablishing or relaunching its hegemony, reinventing it. It's been more creative than the British Empire has been. The British Empire held on to power for quite a while, of course, after it began to slip in the late 19th century, and it's only in the 40s that there's actually passing over the baton to the U.S., but I think that since the 70s, these repeated crises have been used by the U.S. to rewrite the rules, become a revisionist, and basically establish itself as a hegemon. There's a remarkable creativity in that imperial statecraft, I'd say, in the U.S., which we shouldn't underestimate. Something that Adam Tooze has also insisted on. He's a skeptic when it comes to American declinism in a broader sense, because he does think that whether it's under Nixon in the 70s or then under Clinton and Bush in the 90s, and I think even also under Biden, there are these constant ways in which American imperial policy can be quite creative at then re-rigging the rules in their benefit. At the same time, there's another way of looking at this, that the decline is very real. It's just very uneven. So on the military, on the financial side, it's very clear that there's been an increase of American power, whether through dollarization or still having the most powerful army in human history. Then economically, and I would say also politically, it's becoming increasingly impossible to maintain 20th century forms of imperial control. And in many ways, this shows that not all of the revisionist attempts are as successful as we might think they'd be. It's still the British Empire story. Decline is a bit slower. They're a bit more creative, but it's inevitable. But then the pessimistic part of that story is that uneven decline can lead to even more chaos, because it means that the hegemon still has enough power to fight back in some ways. And that really does seem like a very scary prospect. And so a U.S., it would be easy if the U.S. just marginalizes on all fronts. It declines financially, economically, politically, and militarily, and the new hegemon rises, and then you have a confrontation. But instead, the U.S. declines partially and maintains really significant power on some levels. And that might invite all kinds of revanchist or adventurous attempts to maintain a hegemony which is no longer viable. And this is why I'm, yes, very afraid of how the management of decline might play out, because that was not the case with the British Empire. The British Empire did lose its grip on power on all those levels simultaneously. And that is not the case with the U.S. So it was more total decline for the British Empire than partial decline as it is for the U.S. And I think partial decline is actually a recipe for a far more dangerous collapse of global order than total decline.
Especially when you attach it to the Protestant millenarianism that is just baked into the entire American project with the fantasy that you could dominate the world. And also the British imperial shift to me. I mean, this is real big galaxy brain shit, but you know, there's a certain perspective when you're just moving like from one part of the North Atlantic polity to the other, right? That it's not really that gigantic a shift as it might have felt when you're looking at nation states, right? Like the core is like this North Atlantic world that is basically everywhere from Germany and North Europe to the United States is a coherent Wallersteinian political unit, and sort of like shifting from London to New York and DC is not the biggest thing in the world.
No, and it's
obviously not as what's happening here.
No, it's culture. It's also culturally and linguistically contiguous. So as you say, a shift from London to New York, and even the maintenance also of London as a financial center, even as the Americans take over. I mean, that is not a peaceful, but it's a more orderly transition than a world that actually switches poles across the planet, and in which culturally, linguistically, politically, there's a much, much deeper reordering than what happened before.
So just to come to sort of the final discussion, which is how does all of this look from Europe? And I'd really like to hear about it almost a little bit, not by issue to issue, because there's too much. But first, I'd like to talk about Europe and Ukraine and Europe and security. And then maybe this sort of Western European relationship to the United States. Because last time you had a lot of Sturm und Drang, but not much actual change, which, you know, cynically, I would imagine you're going to see something similar. But the problem is the material bases of all of these have shifted in the last 8 years. So you could be forced to see some change. So let's take the view from Europe as our Belgian correspondent.
Yes. So as I said before, I think the absence of an actual opposition in the imperial core has severe and bad consequences also for European politics. And I think one striking fact about the reactions to the election in Europe is that, of course, once again, they've been here before in 2016, but there's a strange hybrid situation now where Europe, certainly under the Biden administration, has become even more severely dependent on American, American imperial support. And its geopolitical agenda is increasingly subject to American priorities. So it has really Americanized. But now it turns out that this re-Americanization or re-subordination, as Wolfgang Streeck calls it, of European policy to American priorities now faces this kind of empty center in Washington. Because I don't think Trump is going to be as ambitious or is going to in any way pursue an isolationist policy that might threaten American interests in Europe. But I do think the Europeans are now stuck between two very difficult positions. But at least Bidenism was a comfortable form of resubordination. It was legible, and now it's no longer legible at all. And in Germany, this has taken extreme forms because it's a country that is used to outsourcing both politically and intellectually all of its thinking and decision-making over foreign policy. And now where it's facing deindustrialization as a real prospect, and it's really, I mean, if you read the reports on this, it's really quite severe. And it's threatening. Deindustrialization doesn't just threaten an economy, it threatens an entire social model. I think it also threatens entire party system, et cetera, et cetera. This is not just an economic, but a social collapse. And they're completely unable to think outside of the constraints that the American world order has imposed on it. And it's, for example, very, very obvious that the connection between German industrial decline and American geopolitical priorities is very clear. But the Europeans have no way of actually conceptualizing this or making this explicit. So as Streeck says, like, everyone knows the dirty secret of what's happening to Germany and how this interacts with worldwide trends and how it has a lot to do with the position that the US has put Europe in. But you can't actually say that out loud. And now that Trump is in power, you can somehow pretend as if you want to be independent from Europe. But in practice, you're not going to be, because you've spent the last 4 to 5 years actually resubordinating very enthusiastically. And
very much so. Kind of funny to see after Trump, just a total resubordination, and particularly after Ukraine.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, I'd say then Europe is clueless in its own way, because, as I said, you've resubjected yourself to a power which you thought you knew what they were doing, and you've actually taken quite significant risks and sacrifices for it. And now it turns out to be that the manager you put your trust in might not be as trustworthy as it turns out to be, but you have nowhere else to turn to. So there are now these desperate plans in Germany to explore Latin American export markets instead of Chinese. But all of that is very experimental, and it actually requires a reckoning with the idea that maybe American priorities shouldn't be European priorities.
That they're not identical. So yeah. Do you see any potential of a rearming of Europe to do things like fight a serious land war with Russia? Do you see any serious forms of economic decoupling, cultural decoupling, or is this just way too early to tell, even if the direction might move in a particular way?
No, I think that's very unlikely. There's also just a question of if you want to increase European military budgets by the percentages which some Trumpites are floating, then that does imply severe pressure on social security budgets and on the European social model. And that's obviously going to have massive knock-on effects also on party politics. So in Germany, Merz, or the leader of the CDU, has already said that you can maintain the so-called debt brake and austerity policies and maintain German industry by cutting through in social spending. So the idea is like change everything to change nothing. But I mean, any cuts to social spending in Germany will immediately further inflame the growing far right. And it means they're really, really stuck. And if only they were able to think outside of the constraints, both cognitively and politically, of the type of America first politics they've been practicing.
Ironically, America first is like the European policy indeed. For decades at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's become more severe. Yeah, so no, I think complete remilitarization is unlikely. If it happens, it will be very socially destabilizing. And no, I don't see that quicker prospect of anything resembling a Europeanism that decouples, because that's what Macron has been trying for the last 5 to 6 years. And there are all kinds of ways in which he has failed. He's only found new ways to fail at that project.
So just as a final question, I mean, to be honest, I'm pretty pessimistic and cynical about the prospects for any of this to get better, for these countries to actually reorganize in any serious way to promote equity and equality, let alone actually put a halt on consumption as a means to at least slightly address climate change. Do you think there's any hope here? What do you think we're going to see in the next few years?
Well, there's a saying by Lenin where he says there's no such thing as an impossible situation. And I think it's an important thing to keep in mind, is that no matter how bleak they look, it's not as if there's no way out ever. And I feel uncomfortable making predictions about where Europe is moving. But looking just at the set of blockages and contradictions which are now accumulating across the continent, it makes me extremely pessimistic about the idea that this decline can somehow be reversed. I think there's a question whether it can be slowed down, it can be cushioned, but the idea that it can be reversed seems wildly implausible to me. You'd actually almost require some kind of revolutionary break. Which doesn't seem on the horizon in any way. So yes, I'm very, very pessimistic, but I mean, the idea that things could get better is, of course, the only thing you can still cling on to.
Well, that is a beautiful note to end on. Anton Yeager, thank you so much. Everyone check out his recent piece in Sidecar, a really interesting analysis of the election. And we'll see you all again soon. Bye.
Thank you.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.